This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Abby Oma-Dunby is the PNC Financial Services Economist we talk to on a regular basis to find out how Northwest Indiana's economy is doing, as well as the rest of Indiana and the Midwest. And Abby, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me again, Chris. It's a pleasure to be back.
Well, if you will, first, give us an idea of how the U.S. residential housing sector is doing these days. I guess it had a pretty strong 2020. Can we expect the same type of strong house price growth as far as 2021 is concerned? Or will the labor market, for that matter, as well as the rest of the market, be affected?
Sure. So housing has been a bright spot during the pandemic. It has led the economic recovery. So we saw double-digit gains in house prices in 2020, and this was the fastest pace since 2013. And housing was driven by very strong demand fundamentals. So there were we had extremely low mortgage rates, and also consumers had very strong balance sheets. And you know, these two factors supported the demand for housing in 2020. Good housing sector is good for many sectors of the economy. It bodes well for manufacturing, for banking, for consumer spending. So it has been, again, a bright spot during the pandemic. I expect the housing sector to remain strong in 2021, but we're likely to see weaker house price growth than what we saw last year. Mm-hmm. And this is because mortgage rates are likely to rise in 2021. It's very unlikely that we maintain the record low mortgage rates we saw last year. And we're also likely to see an increase in housing inventory this year. So as folks get vaccinated and, they feel comfortable listing their homes and having strangers come into their homes, this is going to increase the supply of housing, and it's going to dampen house prices. So there's likely to be weaker house price growth this year than what we saw last year.
I know the realtors have been very concerned for a number of years about the amount of inventory that's out there, that there aren't always the number of homes available to be able to sell when people look for the houses, and that's going to continue to be a problem, as far as you know, certainly for the economic scene?
Those supply challenges are likely to be eased later this year. Mm-hmm. As folks get vaccinated and they feel comfortable listing their homes, there will be an increase in supply, which will help house prices, which will keep house prices moderate in 2021.
Yeah. Now, when will the Northwest Indiana economy seem to return to the pre-pandemic normal, if you want to call it that, or something that we'll have to call as normal these days? And what kind of long-term challenges are we facing locally on the economy?
All right. So the Northwest Indiana economy is better positioned than it was last spring. To put things in perspective, the unemployment rate rose as high as 20% last spring, but it has dropped to 4.7% now as of December. So the economy is trending in the right direction, but it's still below the pre-pandemic level. In February last year, the unemployment rate was 4%, and now it's at about 4.7%. So there's been a lot of progress, but we're still not at pre-pandemic level. Mm-hmm. So it's very likely that the recovery is going to be uneven going forward, and I expect the local economy to return to its pre-pandemic level by 2022 at the earliest.
From the data that you take a look at and putting all your information together for us, do you find that there are any sectors in the local economy that may have some promise of doing better when things do kind of return to this new normal, I guess we'll call it now?
Right. So, as soon as, vaccinations get ramped up and a substantial part of the population, gets vaccinated, there's likely to be an improvement in the services industry. So leisure and hospitality is going to improve as soon as folks feel comfortable congregating in public and, being around in crowds. And we're also going to see a very solid housing sector, which is going to bode well for other parts of the regional economy.
Now, I know to kind of broaden the outlook a bit here, we've seen a rather uneven recovery in the labor market in the recent months here. What does PNC Financial Group's outlook for the labor market and the national economy seem to be?
All right. So economic conditions are likely to pick up in the coming months due to an increase in vaccinations, warmer weather, and also anticipated fiscal policy. It will probably take a few years before the unemployment rate returns to its pre-pandemic level, and that's because so many people have left the labor force. So folks have left the labor force due to health concerns. You know, many folks don't feel comfortable looking for a job now because we're still in a pandemic. And there are also folks who aren't in the labor force due to childcare responsibilities. So it's going to take a couple of years before the labor market returns to its pre-pandemic level. But we expect economic output to return to its pre-pandemic level by the end of this year. And that's because, you know, there's going to be a lot of pent-up demand from consumers who have been waiting, looking for opportunities to spend money. You know, once folks feel comfortable going out and being in public and being in crowds again, there'll be pent-up demand, which will be unleashed and, you know, boost the U.S. economy.
Now, I mean, let me ask a question that's related to the energy problems that portions of the United States, and in particular the South and Texas, seem to have. That was, of course, because of the polar vortex causing so many power problems and water supply problems. That may be a kind of a short-term blip, but is there a possibility that that states like Texas, like the states in the South, that usually don't get this kind of weather calamity that they've been facing, is that going to have a long-term effect economically for them? And in particular in Texas, because of the way that the utilities are set up, is that going to cause any problems financially and economically for them, do you see?
Yeah, so, like, you know, forecasting, like, future weather conditions is in my area of expertise.
Yeah.
But what I will say is that, you know, it's this, what we experienced in Texas was totally unexpected. You know, the states wasn't prepared for it, you know, but I expect the U.S. economy to, you know, continue to improve in the next few months, you know, once we start having warmer weather, you know, once we get anticipated fiscal policy, you know, and once the vaccination rates go up.
Well, Abby, thank you very much for spending time focusing in on Northwest Indiana, the Hoosier economy, and the region economy here in the Midwest. And we appreciate you even taking a look at just even further south of us as to what kind of impact this is all having. You're right. It's maybe easier to predict the economy than it might be to predict the weather forecast sometimes. But it always seems to be that way, I know. Thank you for spending time with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Abby Omadumbi is an economist for PNC Financial Services. You're listening to Regionally Speaking. Any Northwest Indiana resident who is approaching retirement may already have figured out how to have a comfortable retirement in 2021. But just in case, financial advisor Greg Hammer is offering some tips for us here on Regionally Speaking. He begins first his list with some very important facts.
Just the general numbers I want to go over according to studies.
Okay.
That the average spending for an Indiana resident in retirement is about $961,000. And, you know, cost of living is 10.7% less than average, which is good. Monthly ownership costs for senior citizens is, you know, about $400, which is the 11th lowest in the nation. So from a standpoint of, you know, the particular area we're in, costs are relatively low, but mm-hmm. still that $961,000 is a pretty lofty number.
Let me ask about that that monthly home ownership cost number being close to $400 a month. Is that probably because that by the time that you reach the age for retirement that you've pretty much paid down your mortgage, and so that's what your costs turn out to be, really?
Yes, exactly. It's the monthly average cost for senior citizens. So
mm-hmm.
those folks that are kind of well into having most of the debts paid off, you know, aren't as active as, let's say, the younger folks might be and are in a situation where they're, you know, just maintaining, you know, small household expenses.
Now, let's talk first here about retirement spending needs when you have to consider what you need to do to be able to retire. Let's talk about those in more detail first.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing here, Chris, to understand is, you know, people say, well, how much do I need to retire? And while that is obviously a big part of the equation, I think the more important information to understand is, you know, what's coming in, what's going out. Because some folks have, you know, pensions. Some folks have, you know, substantial Social Security income, or they might have other venues of income that create the cash flow they need to pay expenses. So a lot of times it's a budgetary thing, right? How much do we have coming in versus how much do we need? And ultimately what it's about is, you know, what is the gap and how much do we need to, you know, supply the cash flow that we need to cover that gap.
I also suppose, too, that you have to think about, too, how long you're hoping to be in retirement.
And that's really part of understanding your distribution plan. And there's really two sides, Chris, to the time horizon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for those folks that are thinking about how can I retire, understanding how much time you have until that point is really critical in understanding, you know, what types of investments should you be considering. Longer the time horizon, the more it makes sense to utilize growth-oriented type situations because we can, you know, weather the volatility of the markets. The closer we are, conversely, you know, you should consider more conservative allocations. But to your point, you know, how long? You know, what is the longevity in our family? You know, am I retiring at 62 or am I retiring at 70? Which, again, creates a different type of time horizon that you're planning for. And in the big mix of your distribution plan, those are all the things that, you know, by looking at creating that income plan, creating that time horizon that you want to plan for, helps gain a lot of clarity as to, you know, whether or not this is something that you could approach with the assets you have, whether or not you need to look at focusing on, you know, cutting expenses or looking at different types of just instruments to help provide the value, the need to again, cover those gaps. And that's what we always talk about, identify and mitigate gaps that you have in your retirement plan and figure out solutions.
I know that we talk about this, and we have in the past when talking about putting together a good portfolio, that you always have to bring up the subject of risk aversion and how much risk are you willing to take on when you plan ahead. And that's probably true even if you are going to retire soon. You still have to be able to plan for what, especially if you have to save back more money.
Well, yeah, and the biggest thing around risk is, you know, there's a couple phases that we always talk to folks about. You have your accumulation phase and your preservation phase and your distribution phase. And, you know, when you look into distribution, volatility can have a larger impact on asset values than it does in the accumulation phase. And the primary reason simply is you're using the money. So as you're using money, there's a risk called sequence of return risk that is very relevant to distribution planning that you need to understand. And how do we address it? How do we try to mitigate it? Because if we have volatility in distribution, as we know, the worst thing you can do is take money out of an investment when the market's down because you lose the recovery opportunity. And that ties in again with understanding your time horizon and your risk tolerance.
I suppose, too, that also counts, especially if you're especially haven't gotten to quite that point of retirement yet, but you're still trying to save up for it. And that means saving up in that 401k or some other retirement account.
Absolutely, because as you begin to plan this, really understanding and identifying, you know, again, that gap and what you need to cover that gap, and then look at what your plan is pre-retirement to get there. Is it feasible? Is it possible? Or do I need to rethink, you know, maybe how I'm investing and understand time horizons again and, you know, try to get comfortable with the volatility if the time horizon allows us the opportunity to structure our investments in a way where we could potentially reach our retirement goals and create the type of assets that we need to cover those gaps.
Now, what kind of strategies do you recommend to the people that you consult with about trying to be able to find ways to reduce your taxable income as you're getting close to retirement?
Well, and there's a couple of things, right? You know, first and foremost, maxing out retirement contributions, especially matching dollars, are the very first thing that you want to consider. And then in addition to that, what are some of the other things that we can do in the way of potentially Roth IRAs as an example? Given the current tax brackets, understanding that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, you know, using pre-tax contributions today may not be as beneficial as using after-tax dollars because we're probably going to be, you know, historically, if you look at taxes, we are in the lowest tax implications from an income standpoint that we've been in, you know, in my experience in this industry.
Mm-hmm.
So as you begin to contribute, you know, should we contribute when taxes are lower so that when we take them out when taxes potentially go up, you know, we'll do it in a tax-free basis, i.e. the Roth or the 401k Roth. And then there's strategies that you can do in distributions with conversions and look at how that can impact your overall planning standpoint, understanding where and how to take money out of your different assets. So there's a big, you know, there's nothing intuitive as we talk to our clients about the federal tax code. So how you structure your income in retirement often has a large impact on the amount of taxes you pay.
That's Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer offering some tips on being able to have a comfortable retirement in 2021. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
The COVID-19 pandemic has had a big impact on Americans' mental health. Hotline calls have increased, and doctors have seen an increase in depression, like symptoms in patients, even children. Side Effects Public Media's Darian Benson reports that health professionals are encouraging adults to talk to children about mental health and suicide.
At Riley Hospital for Children, there's been a jump in emergency room visits related to mental health and suicide. From March to December, these visits increased 61% compared to the same months in 2019. Here's Hillary Blake, a psychologist at the Indianapolis Hospital.
I think COVID has shown light on it, but I think the mental health crisis has been here for a while. Unfortunately, in the state of Indiana, we don't have enough providers, specifically psychiatrists, to help with children with mental health needs.
Blake says closing schools due to the pandemic has affected students' mental health.
A lot of times, children and adolescents will feel comfortable confiding in a school counselor or a teacher and things like that. I do know that some school counselors are definitely doing things via Zoom and things like that. But it does take a toll because you aren't there face-to-face with the person.
Dr. Paul Nestat is a psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He also says children may feel more anxiety and other distress due to school closings.
We are seeing from surveys, self-reports, higher numbers of distress in kids. That may be related to the fact that kids are impacted uniquely and that they're, you know, cut off from school, which especially to young people has tremendous psychological impact. That's their only outlet. That's their social world. That's their whole world.
Nestat says it's too early to draw a correlation between COVID-19 and suicides.
At the end of the day, we don't have the actual mortality numbers. We are seeing increases in calls to suicide hotlines across the age spectrum, and so that might play out later in actual mortality.
The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is a hotline with a traditionally high number of calls. They are seeing increases during the pandemic. In July, for example, calls increased 6% compared to the previous year. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention's Doreen Marshall says it's never too early to talk to children about mental health.
I think it's helpful to frame mental health as part of our overall health. So recognizing that when we have mental health concerns, that these primarily are health concerns. And I think kids are spoken to at a young age about their health, and really it's about incorporating mental health as part of that discussion.
Marshall says to begin talking with young children about their emotions and how to express themselves. With older children and teens, it is important to introduce the idea of therapy and other resources.
And certainly if there's concerns about suicide, not being afraid to ask your teen directly if they've had thoughts of suicide. You know, the big takeaway is for this to be an ongoing and open dialogue, and to also to reassure them that help is available for their mental health, just like it is for their physical health.
She says it is vital to have these conversations when there are changes in behavior and mood. Marshall says it is a difficult conversation to have, but a necessary one to start.
And then allowing for it to evolve from there, reassuring kids and teens that, you know, if you ever want to talk about something that's distressing you, or if your feelings are ever confusing to you, that I'm somebody that you can talk to and that we can help you get help if that's what's needed.
Marshall says many people fear talking about suicide with young people will make the situation worse. But she says research shows that's not true. It's important to ask directly, letting them know you're a safe person to talk with.
A lot of times thoughts of suicide are really an indicator that our mental health is struggling or that we're feeling overburdened by things. And it's an indicator, just like we have other health indicators, that seeking help and reaching out, it's important to do that.
People in need can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 to reach a trained counselor. From Side Effects Public Media, I'm Darian Benson.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for joining us. Coming up tomorrow, we have Dan Carton with the Times of Northwest Indiana to bring us up to date on the big stories involving the General Assembly that he has put out in print and online. We also have conversations about a couple of tobacco cessation programs that are getting underway, one of which also involves COVID-19, a town hall meeting coming up. And we have a conversation about hearing loss, a very important topic. topic these days during the pandemic. All that's ahead here on Regionally Speaking. We hope you'll join us tomorrow.